It is affirmed in the scripture that God himself does not tempt any man with evil, and that temptation to evil, solicitation to evil, comes wholly and solely from the evil one. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, trial. For when he hath been approved, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempteth no man, but each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. Then the lust, when it hath conceived, beareth sin, and the sin, when it is full grown, bringeth forth death, my beloved brethren. In verse 2, that's reading in James 1, beginning in verse 12, and then continuing down through verse 15, count it all joy, verse 2. My brethren, when ye fall into manifold temptations, knowing that the proving of your faith worketh patience or steadfastness. In entering upon some thoughts about these matters, it's very imperative that we understand that the term that is used in temptation or trial is a term that has in its very setting a context always. It is to put something to a test. And when Satan brings about a testing of your life or mine, his object always is to break us down, to reduce us to ruin. His intent and his purposes is to make us his and one of his own kind through trying us in order to make us what he wants us to be. In that point of view, God does not tempt any man. On the other hand, we can read in the scripture where God did test and try, and that has seemed to some to be contradictory. But now comes the other side of that consideration and makes it quite clear that we do not deal with a contradiction. God, in putting men to trial, in the development of their character, undergoes continual refinement or testing, but that is for refining and for bringing out what's good. So the thing itself is rather neutral in character, testing something. If the devil tests it, it's in order to destroy and ruin it. The Lord's testing it is in order to develop it and to make it good. Consequently, when James says that God does not tempt any man, does not try any man, it's in this sense or context in which the devil does. On the other hand, James says that the effect of trial in the man who is what he ought to be makes him better. That's true. Whereas, on the other hand, if there is in the man the flaw, it may very well develop the flaw. You and I cannot escape the fact that we are not just pawns and that we are completely in the control of the devil, and what we do, we can't help it because the devil is stronger than we are. Or on the other hand, that God somehow, in some manner that we do not understand, converts people and makes them into something, and they're just good, and they just can't do any wrong. These utterly false concepts get involved right along in people's thinking about religious matters. When in the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul discusses the conduct of Israel under the leadership of Moses and how that they had received great privileges and blessings. They had all been baptized under Moses. There's the subtle suggestion, we have been baptized under Christ. And they had spiritual food and spiritual drink. They had manna from heaven, and they had water from the rock. These God himself supplied them. So, made one with God and sustained supernaturally food and drink in the wilderness, nonetheless, with all of those benefits that they had, they did not please God. For all of the good that was showered upon them, they failed. Here is given an adverse example. Here is a case that held up to view that disappointing. In fact, we spoke at some length the last Lord's Day upon this very fact of Israel's coming right up to the point of receiving the land and having provoked and vexed God from the day they came out of Egypt. They then committed the supreme folly of refusing to go over into the land of Canaan and accepting the inheritance out of a lack of faith in God, and God turned them back in the wilderness to die. It's in this same tone that Paul in the Corinthian letter holds up these people, and when he has recited their history, then he says, now all of these things happened unto them by way of the example. And they were written, he said, for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages are come, in which the consummation of these periods of time that are thought of, each of them as a period or a part of the whole of time itself. Time to this point has been made up of the ages, and here is that end or aim or point. After all of these ages at which we stand, and what happened there is an example to us. Now he said, wherefore, verse 12, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Now he has something to say in reference to what we were talking about a moment ago, this trying or testing out of people. There hath no temptation, no trial, no testing through which man passes. And it wouldn't make any difference whether it is of God or of the... There is no trial that man has been exposed to, he says, but such as man can bear. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that ye are able, but will with the temptation make also the way of escape, that ye may endure it. Consequently, the rough time that the Corinthians thought they were in, and he concludes in the next statement, wherefore, my beloved brethren, flee idolatry, and that goes right on. The rough time that the Corinthians were having in their daily lives, living in a city of gross idolatry, the conflicts it brought them into with the citizenry, these are problems that they're being consoled with. Meet your problems. God will help you. This business of undergoing testing and trying, it's the only way that character can be developed, where we finally turn out to be what we ought to be, or we break down and are shown to be what we ought not to be. All of that remains to be seen in the sum total of our life when we have finished it here upon the earth. There is a statement in the Hebrew letter when in the third chapter the writer is talking about Moses faithful in all of God's house as a servant, where the word house does not mean a domicile or residence, but it means a household, a people. Moses was a part of God's people, and he was a faithful servant in this household of God. But he comes on to say that Christ is a son over the house, the household again. Moses the servant, Christ the son. But while he's making a contrast between Moses and Christ to show that Christ is greater than Moses, a very important point to these Hebrew Christians to whom the writer is addressing himself, he now stops to say something that bears upon what we wish to pursue a little farther. He then says, but Christ as a son over his house, whose house are we if we hold fast our boldness and glorying of our hope firm unto the end. That's why he goes on to say in verse 14, for we are become partakers of Christ. That is, we get the benefits of Christ. We share, we participate in the benefits of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our confidence, steadfast unto the end. This word confidence is well put here because faith itself is the conviction of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And to hold fast our confidence is the result, of course, the confidence itself is the result of our belief in and our dependence upon God, and holding fast suggests the difficulty of doing so amid the trials and the difficulties that life has that continually confront us and would, if the devil has his way about it, seduce us to break our confidence in God. I thought this evening for the moments of our study that it would be helpful to us all, hopefully, to think for a little bit in the vein of this particular concept now, holding fast, being God's people, that the real essence of whether or not we're what we ought to be is to be seen in our ability, with God's help, to be unmoved, as Paul expresses it in 1 Corinthians 15, be ye therefore steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Is that true? I don't mean is it true what he said, but I mean is it true of us, each of us for ourselves? Is it true that in the face of what we meet as we go through life, and there's no escaping the fact that we're all put under test? That testing goes on all of the time. And the result of the testing shows whether we're pure metal, good metal, gold or silver, precious metal, or whether we're base, something that is unfitted. When the refiner puts gold to the test, fire burns away and melts down and makes a separation between the dross and the pure metal. And it is seen as that refining process in the life of people by which the trial that goes on has a way of continually taking out the dross and refining the good. There is a tendency in our hearts to cry out against the difficulties. It's natural that we would like for it to be that to live a Christian life is, that's easy, nothing to it. Going to hell ought to be a hard thing. Going to heaven ought to be real easy. But the fact of the business is, It's the reverse. And that causes people to have some strange thoughts about God. This is God's world. And we are the creatures of God's creation. God made us. And He made us like we are. Oh, we'd like for it to have been differently. We'd like to be made so that we don't ever have to be exposed to any trial or any hardship. It's like gold in the rock, which in the rock is unusable. The rock has to be crushed. And all of the dross and the rubble has to be eliminated, and the pure metal has to be retrieved and recovered. Your life and mine is so much like that. There is so much in us that draws. And life should be, in its refining process, what continually shows up more and more of the real thing that we are. But we don't like the process, because to be crushed, to be melted down, to have to go through the process is painful. And I think that there are many people, I base that upon simple observation and conversation, association with people through the years, who have a difficulty understanding why living a Christian life is difficult. Now, on the other hand, don't get me wrong, living a sinful life is easy only in the sense that it requires no effort to get involved in it. But don't think for one moment that it's easy once you get in it. The Old Testament wisely, through the wise man, has observed the way of the transgressor. It's hard. And you better believe it. It's hard. The difference between a way that is hard without any respite and a way that is difficult, but possible and with help, is what we're talking about. Not a way that's easy and skylarking and good, no problems at all, and another one that's hard and miserable, but you get to go to heaven that way, and the other way, oh, it's a wonderful way, but you end up going to hell. That isn't the truth of it. There isn't anything more deceptive than the concept that going to hell is a lot of fun. There isn't any fun, except in the momentary act. That's all the fun there is. Whereas the good that comes and accumulates. You know, this is not only true of heaven, but it's true of life itself. A life that's worthwhile isn't lived in a minute. You don't get it all right now. Some of our problems, and it was true when I was younger, and it's true with you, I suppose, in every generation, a young person is, in this respect, just like another. We're who we are. We're who we are right now. And what we want right now. And impatience. Young people want what they want right now. And they'll worry about the next step when to get that. That's the devil's leverage. That's the fulcrum that he has. He'll pay you right now. But it's a paltry wage, and what you get on top of the table is not what you're going to get that he slips to you under the table. And Moses was wise enough that he had to make a decision at a point in his life, and he chose to suffer hardship with the children of God. He made that choice rather than what? Than to enjoy the pleasures of sin. Hardship against pleasure. But now wait a minute. Pleasures of sin, which are for a season. Now what about when the season's up? Ah, that's when you pay for the game. The devil operates on a sort of a you get it now and pay later. It's installment living. You understand installment buying. You may understand it to your regret. It's enjoy it now and pay for it later. Installment living is what the devil talks about. Lots of fun. And you can have it right now. And let me tell you, when you get it, that's all you ever get of the fun. And then the hell starts in, and you never get rid of that. But that's what you didn't bargain for. Now that's the testing that we go through with. There is no way. There is no way that man lives in this world without undergoing trial. One way said, well, you go to heaven, you undergo trial. Go to heaven, don't have, go to hell, you don't have any trials. Don't you deceive yourself about that? Hell is not way off in the future somewhere. All of it, and all of heaven isn't way off in the future somewhere either. Here again, the devil wants you to believe that you can have all the fun you want to right now, and you can let the future take care of itself, and heaven's way off in the sky somewhere, and you can worry about that later when you get to it. And you get old and don't have anything else to do, then you can talk about going to heaven. Too much fun right now. That's the devil's lie. There isn't a word of truth in that. And people learn only to their regret. I was about to say, there is no escaping the fact that to develop as God made us, characters, creatures with choice of moral character. We may choose the direction. That's the badge of being a man. There isn't an animal on earth that has that choice. Puppies can just grow up and be dogs. There's no choice about it. They don't have any choice about which direction they go. There is no morality in a dog. There is no immorality. They're just dogs, period. But a human being has responsibility. And we grow up either for the better or for the worse. And who determines that? That's the essence of temptation. And the only way we ever get a deposit in a bank of moral worth or spiritual worth is the result of sweat and toil. We don't get it handed to us on a platter. You know, some people get money, and that's just power. But they get lots of power. And with power, you can have people wait on you. You can have what you want. They get money by inheriting it. We have the expression that goes about a fellow born with a silver spoon in his mouth. That fellow never asked once, but just stand there and write a check to him all the time. I doubt that it's quite that way. But even so, there are some who are to the manner born. And they are wealthy in this world's goods to begin with. And apparently without much sweat, they have everything they want. The other fellow, he has to work hard to get that little savings account in the bank. And he looks over at the other fellow and said, look what he's got, and I have to work so hard for mine. What I'm saying is, there's only one way for any of us to get ahead spiritually. And that, if you please, is hard work. But it's worth every effort. It's worth all of it. And I want to suggest now, looking at the life of Abraham, how Abraham went through some testing. I don't want to look at all of it in the sense of, don't make that a lesson, we're just going to drag a thing out. Don't intend to do that. When I say don't want to, I mean don't intend to develop it that way. I want to offer a few things, just a sort of a story form for us to think about. And I don't suppose that preachers have to just preach to people and draw them a picture of everything they're trying to convey. I think sometimes just suggestions. Let's think back, since Abraham is held up in the Scripture as the father of the faithful. He's the one that, when you look at his life, you get an idea about what a faithful fellow is when you look at Abraham, because he's the fountainhead. He's flesh and blood like you and I. And yet of all the people in the world, God separated Abraham, and that's the first test, and called him out from his family, called him out from the land where he lived, and separated him. That's the first test that Abraham went through with. I'd call it the test of separation. Over in the book of Judges, the 24th chapter, the second verse, we find that the father of Abraham was an idolater. And there is every reason to believe that Abraham himself was really an idolater, without really an accurate knowledge of the true God. How much he knew or didn't know, I really can't say. But this background of idolatry that's spelled out. Now, when a time came for Abraham to start this walking with God thing, the first test was, get thee out from thy country, from among thy kindred, and come out to a place that I will show thee, and will afterward give thee for an inheritance. I like to just call that test separation. Separation, sanctification, doesn't take much imagination to understand that they're both involved. Be ye separate, saith God. Touch not the unclean, it says. And I will be unto you a father, and ye shall be unto me sons and daughters. Sanctification. There is in your life and mine a recurring call to separation. It's laying aside, putting away, stepping apart from. That's part of living Christian life. Old Abraham exemplifies that in the very beginning. When he's called to come out from his family and from his people and go out, and he's not even told where. He goes out, the writer of the Hebrew letter says, not knowing where he went. He gave up what he had, what he couldn't see, and went out not seeing anything. Not only that, but he had a great deal of privation in going out. That is, he didn't come over to overnight success. He didn't become wealthy, though in time he did. That's another matter in a moment. But he left, and that's the first point I want to make with you, and I guess I've made that. That test of separation. I would say that out of that test of separation, you and I learn. Of course, we anticipate it as we read it because we have the benefit of history. We know he should have gone. We know what a great thing he would have missed if he hadn't gone. But the fact of the business is, Abraham didn't know what you and I know because ours is historic previous afterthought. We're looking back. And we know the end of the story, but he was in on the beginning of it. But in spite of that, that faith, he got up and went. Now, when he got up and went out by faith, he took Lot, his nephew, with him. They got over into the land of Canaan, but it was not given to them. They're in it, but they're strangers and sojourners. They're pilgrims. They're nomads. They're not permanently in the land. And so living in tents, they move about over the land with their cattle and so forth, but they hardly get settled in until a drought sets in. And they go down to Egypt in order to sustain themselves. Come to the second text. Going down into Egypt, Abraham gets to thinking about it as they near the borders of Egypt. Sarah, his wife, is evidently a very beautiful woman. Though it's interesting to me to know that Sarah was 65 years old at this time. Now, in the lifespan of people today, 65-year-old women are not generally any beauty contestants. But be that as it may, Sarah lived to be, and in that day people lived longer, she lived to be 127 years old. So at 65, she was only in her midway lifespan, and no matter, she was a very comely woman. And Abraham is sensible that people are just like we know people are today. Pretty women, attractive women, are really in a very difficult situation. While no one is ugly because they won't be ugly, and people are just beautiful because they're beautiful. It's nothing over which they immediately have any control. Their actions and attitude goes with it, like some of the good women used to say, pretty is pretty does. Yeah, that's, I buy that. But it still doesn't make the mirror say anything pretty to you when you look in it. Well, you can behave yourself. But anyway, Abraham knew that when Sarah got down there in Egypt, that there'd be some fellas who'd want her. And knowing that she was his wife, they would not hesitate to do him in to get her. People hadn't changed a whole lot. And Abraham's mulling this over in his mind, and he said to her what the problem was. And he said to her, put out the word when we get down in Egypt that you're my sister. I'd take that, you know, that'd take heat off me. Sure enough, when they got into Egypt, people saw him. And the courtiers, the ones in the king's inner circle of friends, took word to him and said, say, quite a good-looking woman. And the king thought so too. And in no time at all, Abraham found himself the object of the king's bounty. The king made very generous gifts to him in cattle, being a nomad now. He gave him livestock. He gave him good clothing. After all, it's his sister, you know, that he's looking at, but he's good to the brother. And this thing gets even worse. He even has Sarah brought into his court. This is just leading right on up to making her a part of his harem. Can't you imagine the anxiety of all of this situation? And yet, right at the climatic point of entry, God steps in and afflicts the family of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh understands that what is happening. Now, don't ask me how he understood it. We're not given any details about that, but he did. He made the connection between that and this woman. And pressing the point, discovered indeed she was a married woman. Abraham was her husband. And the king, while very angered by the imposition that had been wrought on him, nonetheless, has his men take Abraham and all of his possessions, very kind to him, but he sends them packing. He takes them out, sends them back home. Now, there is this lesson, I would say, of the famine. I would call it the temptation of famine. When Abraham thought by his own chicanery, I think of no better word than that, to alleviate the pressure on himself that this famine brought on, when he had to go down to Egypt and go down there, but this thing involved, and so to preserve himself, he figured this is the way to do it. He's just as wrong as he can be. And what we learn is God has ways of taking care of those things. And when Abraham got in a bind and this thing still got out of hand, and what he had planned just fell to pot, but God stepped in completely above and beyond, took care of it, and Abraham gets off the hook. And that should have taught Abraham something that, incidentally, we ought to learn. And what is that? The very thing we read in the First Corinthian letter a moment ago. There is not a trial. Do you believe that? Do I believe it? There is not a testing that we're put into in which right and wrong is involved that the door of opportunity is not opened up and God fixes it so that the outcome of it does not endanger my soul. I didn't say where I got all scot-free and didn't have to say anything, but there's always a door of escape. That's the problem. Well, no sooner does he get back up in the land than some more things. This is life, you know. It's just climbing out over one hill and get on top of that. There's one a little higher on the other side. And you always won't see what's on the next. If you don't, we're going to get there anyhow. So, in time, when they settled back up in the land of Canaan, he and Lot, they became very wealthy. And a third trial comes into the life of Abraham. I would call it the test of wealth. He's a very wealthy man. Their flocks increase, and they discover that actually between the two of them, Abraham and Lot, the grazing land is really not sufficient. They're herdsmen, in fact. They kind of run on open range out there, family ground. And the herdsmen that were in the employment of Lot and the herdsmen who were in the employment of Abram were arguing with one another and jousting one another about over the grazing land. And when Abraham was faced with that trial, Now, he could have just sent Lot packing, you know. He'd get out. And Abraham had the power, and yet he had a decision to make. He showed a remarkable characteristic that we ought to think about. He said to Lot, "Now we be brethren." That's something to think about. And we can't afford this business of fighting and jarring and having this sort of thing going on. And then he could have said, and for that reason, maybe you better get out. he could have said that, you know. But he made it clear that something had to give, and that wasn't anything that was strange to Lot. But here's what he did. The largeness of his, the bigness of his faith, most men wouldn't do it. He said to Lot, "You just decide what you want. And if you choose the east, I'll take the west. If you take the left, I'll take the right. Your choice. Not flip a coin. Just you make the choice." And Lot was just as magnanimous as Abraham in reverse. He looked out over the good regions of the Jordan that were well watered and good pastures, and said, "I believe we'll take that." And that was the best there was. But that was Abraham's proposition. He stood with it. And he let Lot have all the good land, the good pasturage, the better at least, and he parted. Now here comes the temptation or trial that's put on a man when he's got lots of substance. And a man never has so much that it's really enough. I can recall vividly back in the 20s when I heard that there were some people in the town where I lived that had to pay income tax. But you know, you had to make $10,000. Think about it. You had to make $10,000 a year to pay income tax. And my reaction to that was, so what? If I had $10,000, I could care less whether you had to pay tax or not. No problem. I've thought about that many times. But I'm sure that the man who paid income tax in 1927 and 2080 had the same feelings about paying income tax you and I have in 1980. That's the last one, wasn't it? All right. This business of enough was what I'm talking about. Just got enough. It does matter. And Abraham passed that test and comes out in good order. Then there comes the test of delay. You know, God had promised Abraham a number of things, giving him the land, of course. But among other things, he had promised him an heir. He had promised to make of him a mighty nation. In fact, he comes out strong about this period of Abraham's life and makes that promise again to him. Abraham is very despondent because he has no heir. And he complains to the Lord, in fact, that he said, "Here I am, an old man, and my heirs are none. And if I die, this Eliezer of Damascus is my boss man, and he's my heir. He gets my fortune. I don't have an heir to turn my fortune over to." And he's very despondent about it. And God makes him a promise. And yet the promise of an heir is not forthcoming. Time just goes on, and there's still no child. And finally then, Sarah herself offers that suggestion, the story's familiar to all of us, that he take the Egyptian servant woman that was her handmaiden and by her produce a child, since Sarah could bear no children. That would fulfill the promise, they reason. And so, the test of delay. And Abraham again falls back on his strategy. Here he begins to figure out how to live. Sure enough, the handmaid conceived by Abraham and bore him a son, Ishmael. But after Ishmael was born, and Abraham was real happy about all of that because he saw in Ishmael, "Now this is my boy, and he's my heir, and I'm happy now." But all at once God said to Abraham, "This man shall not be thine heir." That just throws the whole thing into a cocked hat. Well, if he isn't the heir, who is? And then God said about this time, next year Sarah will bear you a son. Well, this is ridiculous. But God promised it. The promise was fulfilled. And it came out in God's plan when God was ready. I've thought about that many times in other connections, some in connection with my own life, some in connection with things that people say to me. Then when I read in the New Testament about the people over in Thessalonica where you've been studying on Sunday morning in some recent weeks, and they had had the promise of the coming of the Lord, an eternal judgment, a reckoning with mankind, and yet the Lord hadn't showed up. They were very concerned about it. Some were already dead, and others were dying, and the Lord still hadn't come. These good people are going to be left out, they thought. This is one of the problems. They were wrong about that. Here, 2,000 years have gone by, and the Lord hadn't come yet. In fact, in Peter's time, Peter talks about that, and there are some scoffers, he said, who will say, where is the promise of his coming? The implication being, he's not coming. And they're going to say, will say, everything continues since the world started just like it was. The sun comes up and the sun goes down. One day after another, there's not going to be any end of the world. Now, Peter said this, they willfully forget. It isn't true that this whole world continues just as it was. There was a time when God destroyed this world with a flood. One of the fellows said, well, the old world, God's not going to do anything because everything continued just as it was from the beginning. No, he overlooked something. There was a destruction of the earth back there with water. Peter said, this time it's going to be a fire. Oh, it'll come. Of course, since that has come up as a point, there's been the date setters, and you notice now that in our own city there's been a convention of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And they're anticipating rather fearfully this convention because they've got what they call some troublemakers among them now, because several years ago the prophet group of the Jehovah's Witnesses, Watchtower Tract and Bible Society that runs them, predicted by some calculations that they've worn out their calculators on, that the end of time was going to come in 1975 or, and they slid their slide rule just a little bit, maybe at the hour, but it's got to be 75 or 76. Right in there. That's it. Well, no need to tell you, it didn't happen. Now they've got some people in the Jehovah's Witness group, bless your heart, they're still in the bunch, but they're just fussing with the others and saying, yeah, it didn't happen. They're troublemakers. I kind of think the fellow with the slide rule was the fellow that caused the problem. In fact, I've got that feeling about all of them. They've been date setters from the time that old William Miller started that set. Well, he didn't start that one. He started his own. Back in 1845, before 45, he predicted the end of the world. He made exactly the same prediction and even set the 19th day of October of 1845 as the day that the Lord would come. Well, I don't give you any surprise when I tell you it didn't. And he looked over his figures and he said, well, now I made a mistake. It's really next year. Made me think of the 75 or 76, just a year's difference. You know, when you're dealing with thousands, you make a little slip. So, next year came, and so intense was the fervor among the Millerites. This was William Miller, and it was the Millerite movement. So fervent was this thing that the people made themselves ascension robes. Not only that, but they gave up their jobs as the 19th of October drew near. They quit work. And then when the 19th day of October came, beginning at midnight, they climbed upon barns in their ascension robes like sheeted ghosts. They sat on rooftops and climbed in trees and climbed poles like cats. and sat out the day waiting for the coming of the Lord, and disconsolate when another midnight rolled by and the Lord didn't come, they drooped their way and panned their way into retreat. William Miller retired to lick his wounds and never raised his head again, but out of the broken, shattered remnant of the old Millerite movement came Mrs. Ellen G. White with her revelations, and that started the Seventh-day Adventists on the one side, and the rest of the old Millerite movement were formulated under a fellow by the name of Russell. That was the Russellites. That's the JWs. That's the Jehovah's Witnesses, and he's the daddy of the whole thing, and all of it came out of the shambles of the false predictions of old William Miller. And then Pastor Russell, who was a young man, started over the country preaching under a big banner, Miller's Mistake. And he had Miller's old notes and his prophetic figures, and he refigured them and said it was 1914 that the Lord was coming. And he died before 1914, but 1914 ushered in World War II or World War I, and still no coming of the Lord. A young man, J.F. Rutherford, stepped in and took the mantle of old Pastor Russell and refigured it, and it was really 1918 that the Lord was going to come. 4 years to breathe. 1918 came, and the Lord didn't come in, but they said he really came. Oh, yes, he did. You just can't see him. God forbid. What is more ridiculous, people believed it, and they call that the cleansing of the temple, and the Lord came and cleansed the temple. Gracious. That was 1918. Now the weary years have passed, and then they came up again with their prophecies for 75 or 76, their liars again. And those that are within their ranks who are now saying you're wrong, they're saying, shut up, you're just troublemakers. Maybe they got more trouble than they can deal with if they only knew it. And that's just part of their trouble, of false prophecy and false teaching. But back to the point. Delay, we were saying, is in itself a great temptation for people to lose hope. Just delay. Things are going to be better. But it looks like they're getting worse. See? And people get discouraged. James speaks in this note, and he says, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will exalt you in due time. It'll be all right. Depend on God. That's exactly how it works. And when the thing came about, God did it in his way, and Abraham's little sidetrack trying to take on and figure it out, he had to learn again. God's ways are not man's ways. God's thoughts are not man's. And his faith goes right on. Let me come to a concluding point. One more trial of Abraham. As we said, we're not trying to pick every detail, but these are virtual mountain peaks in the life of Abraham. When Isaac, the son of promise, was about 21 years old, he's called a youth or a lad. Don't let that deceive you.